to get a stat over there because otherwise I'm giving God to me. It's him. And I wasn't going to have an image, but since Carl had one, I had to have one. This is Leonardo da Vinci's St. Anne, the child of St. Anne. So I'm going to be talking about that briefly. And before I start, just two caveats or perhaps disclaimers. One is that I'm not a psychoanalyst or a profound reader of Freud. So what I have to say here is not sort of from that angle. This paper is not part of a larger project either, but it is part of a continuing interest in the way in which animals are sort of fictionalized, in the way in which animals become figures in literature, but also in this case, in Freud. So without further ado, Freud's Vulture. In Leonardo da Vinci and the Memory of His Childhood, which was published in 1910, Freud embarked for the first time on a full-length biography, applying the methods of psychoanalysis on the life of a historical figure. It has become a classic, in part because it marked the beginning of an entirely new approach to the study of personality, and set in motion a new trend of investigation, which he called psychobiography. But it is also famous because Freud's interpretation of Leonardo is famously based on a mistranslation. The most important piece of evidence in Freud's analysis is Leonardo's memory, or fantasy, of being visited in his cradle by a bird of prey. In his notebooks, Leonardo uses the word nebbio, or nebbio, what would one be, and the other one was two bees, which is Italian for kite. But in his study, Freud uses the German word Gaia, vulture in English, to refer to Leonardo's bird. Freud seems to have been using a German translation of Leonardo's text, which uses the word Gaia instead of Milan, which is a German word for kite. But the error seems to have been compounded by a second source that also uses the word Gaia, the German translation, which is the German translation of a novelized book on Leonardo, which was originally written in Russian by Dmitry Mizrakovsky, a marked copy of which is found in Freud's library, and which uses the correct word for kite in Russian, which is korshun. I will have more to say about the problem of mistranslation in Freud's text, but my aim in what follows is not to quarrel with Freud's interpretation of Leonardo, much less to establish the role of error in psychoanalysis. I want instead to use the text's taxonomic confusion as an occasion to reflect on the role of animals in our understanding of human sexuality, and in doing so, on the role this particular view of sexuality plays in our understanding of sex in the animal world. I take my cue from Leo Bersani, for whom moments of tension, contradiction, and even what he calls theoretical collapse in Freud's work are to be listened to affirmatively, even celebrated, as a performative and ultimately instructive function of the very nature of Freud's objects of speculation. End quote. So on to Freud's Leonardo. For Freud, Leonardo is a puzzle. He finds in his, quote, dual nature as an artist and a scientist, an inspiring but enigmatic figure. On the one hand, Leonardo engaged in different types of scientific research. He dissected the bodies of animals and of humans. He designed flying machines. He invented deadly weapons for the Duke of Milan. He studied the nutrition of plants and the reactions to different poisons, and on and on. On the other hand, he was a gifted artist, perhaps the most gifted artist ever, the artist who painted some of the most iconic works of art, such as Mona Lisa, The Last Supper, The Virgin and the Child of St. Anne, which is this picture here. Leonardo, however, was incapable of finishing what he started. He has notebooks, but little to show for them. He only painted 7 paintings. That was it. His character for Freud is fascinating because he was unsuited to the life that he led. He was unsuited to the life of the artist because he was indolent, he was gentle, he was indifferent to fame, and at least in Freud's telling, he was what we would today consider something of an advocate for animal rights. This is Freud writing. He says, "He is said to have abstained from eating meat, thinking it unjustifiable to rob animals of their lives, and to have taken a particular pleasure in buying birds in the market and even setting them free. He condemned bloodshed and said that man was not so much the king of the animal world as the worst of its savage beasts." End quote. In addition, his sexual life was something of a mystery. Freud tells us that Leonardo was, quote, "an example of the cool rejection of sexuality," end quote, and was never known to have, quote, "held a woman in a passionate embrace," end of quote. According to Solmi, one of the biographers Freud quotes, Leonardo once said that, quote, "the act of procreation and everything connected with it is so disgusting that mankind would soon die out if it were not an old established custom and there were not still pretty faces and sensual natures," end of quote. There is also a useful episode that confirms for Freud the suspicion that Leonardo has suppressed his sexual impulses. Quote, "When he was living as an apprentice at the house of his master, Verrocchio," Freud tells us, "a charge of unlawful homosexual practices was brought against him and other young people, but it ended in his acquittal," end of quote. Drawing from his experience as a psychoanalyst, Freud suggests that Leonardo fits the profile of a passive or ideal homosexual whose repressed sexual interests have been sublimated into an urge for research. But he needs further evidence. And for Freud, perhaps unsurprisingly, the solution to the puzzle is to be found in Leonardo's childhood. Leonardo, the illegitimate son of a well-to-do notary, was born to a peasant woman and brought up from the age of 5 by his father's wife, who was childless. And it is not the circumstances of his childhood that determine his psychical development alone. As Adam Phillips cautions, Freud showed that, quote, "childhood informed everything but predicted nothing." In order to understand how it is that Leonardo became Leonardo, Freud submits the only piece of information about his childhood that we find in his scientific writings, the story of the childhood memory, to the rigors of psychoanalysis. And this is the story of the vulture, to which I now turn. Leonardo, as is well known, studied very carefully the flight of birds. And in a passage dealing with the flight of the vulture, or kite, Freud tells us, he, quote, "suddenly interrupts himself to pursue a memory from his very early childhood that has sprung to mind," end of quote. This is what Leonardo writes, and Freud is actually quoting Leonardo from his own notebooks. Quote, "It seems that I was predestined to study the vulture, or kite, so thoroughly, because I recall as a very early memory that when I was still in my cradle, a vulture, or kite, came down to me, opened my mouth with its tail, and struck me many times with this tail against the lips," end of quote. It is not clear to Freud if this is a true recollection, a screen memory, or a latter-day fantasy Leonardo uses to, as he puts it, dignify his study of bird flight by the idea that it was predestined. With the tools of psychoanalysis, however, Freud is able to read it thus. The tail, coda in Italian, is a word regularly used to refer to the penis in many different languages. The fact that the tail beats on his lips corresponds to fellatio. This act, in turn, is a variant of the child sucking at his mother's breast. Freud then adds an unexpected twist. Quote, when the child later becomes acquainted with the cow's udder, which has the function of a nipple and the shape and abdominal position of the penis, he has reached the preliminary stage that leads to the formation of the offensive fantasy in question, end of quote. A fantasy that is only offensive to middle class society, as he says, since he insists it is not to be considered a perversion. It is, quote, very common among women today, end of quote. The recollection, which is a reminiscence of sucking or being suckled at his mother's breast, becomes for Freud a passive homosexual fantasy. But this only raises further questions. Why is the mother replaced by a vulture or a kite? Freud puts it this way, quote, where does the vulture or kite come from and how does it enter the story? The answer Freud provides is the most unsatisfactory element of his interpretation, since up to this point, the difference between a kite and a vulture is insignificant. Leonardo's fantasy would lead to the same interpretation, regardless of whether it involved a kite or a vulture, or for that matter, any bird with a long tail. But Freud wants more. He wants to push his interpretation further, to show how a desire is sublimated into art, or as he calls it, research in general, which refers both to science, art, but also sexual research, sexual desire. He suggests that the vulture, not a kite this time, represents the figure of the mother in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. And in addition, that one of the mother goddesses in Egyptian mythology was represented by a vulture head. The name of the goddess is Mut, which is reminiscent of the German word for mother, Mutter. Can this be fortuitous? He asks. According to Freud, Leonardo, who is not only very well read, but also lived in Milan, which was a center of the new art of printing, and he doesn't make the pun, but Milan apparently is kite in German, which was a center of the new art of printing, may have come across a fable rendered in Latin in at least one version, but originally Egyptian, that tells of single-sex vultures getting impregnated by the wind. Freud suggests that this fable may have informed Leonardo's childhood fantasy, giving him the sense that he too was a vulture's child. That is, that he had no father. Freud then ties this fantasy to Renaissance iconography of the Blessed Virgin and her child, and suggests that Leonardo may have identified himself with Christ the child. Proof of this identification, according to one of Freud's friends, can be found in Leonardo's painting, The Virgin and Child with Saint Anne, on which one can trace, in the woman's drapery, the shape of the vulture. So more or less, his interpretation is that if you look at the sleeve, that would be the tail, since the boy seems to be suckling it, and that the blue is more or less in the shape of a bird, if you see it sort of upside down. That's the interpretation of a friend. Freud was reluctant to accept it, but he did include it as a footnote in his book. So you can see that it's more or less shit. And the painting is from 1503, by the way. The painting also contains another interesting element, which is the enigmatic smile of the women characters, which, according to Freud, is found in all his paintings, including the Mona Lisa, and it represents the mother that he left behind. That's his interpretation. Now, this part of Freud's interpretation of Leonardo's childhood fantasy falls apart in light of the problem of translation. But it does highlight a more general problem in Freud that is more to our purpose here. Why are animals so prevalent in our discussions of human sexuality? On the one hand, we tend to think of sex as the most natural thing there is, as that which expresses our animal natures in ways that other aspects of our lives do not. Yet, on the other hand, it is to refer to non-normative sexualities, or as Freud would perhaps call them, pathologies or perversions, that we tend to use animal imagery as if animal sexuality were somehow itself unnatural. Animal sexuality is never perverse. And we saw the first intervention yesterday in which we look at it in many different ways, even mechanically, and we don't think of it as in any way perverse or pathological. For Freud, though, the matter is quite clear. In analysis of a phobia in a five-year-old, colloquially known as Little Hans, that's the case history, Freud writes, quote, "The importance of animals in myth and fairy tale is due in no small measure to the openness with which they display their genitalia and their sexual functions to the curious young child." End of quote. So let me turn briefly to Freud's case histories in order to show how he uses animals as placeholders for something other than animal sexuality, and how these animals are also, in a way, mistranslated in the case histories. So the first one I'm going to talk about is colloquially known as the rat man, officially is called Notes on a Case of Obsessional Neurosis. The rat man's fear that a certain Oriental torture technique involves rats boring their way into a victim's anus was at the root of his complex obsessional neuroses, according to Freud. Part of the rat man's routine involves the highly elaborate way in which he goes about performing tasks that involve money. Freud points out, this is a pun that the rat man actually tells him about, that there's an unconscious pun on Ratten, German for rats, which is a word that closely resembles Ratten, German for installments. And then he goes on to show how the word Ratten is connected to Ratman's father, who had accumulated a large gambling debt and was referred to in the slang of the time as a gambling rat. Freud argues that Ratten for Ratman has come to be associated with anything that circulates. Money, penises, words, thoughts, etc. So you see here already the play of words. He's already translating or mistranslating, if you will, the word rat. Another analysis, this one is colloquially known as Little Hans, but officially it's called Analysis of a Phobia in a Five-Year-Old Boy. This is what he has to say. In this case, Little Hans has developed a fear of horses. And when asked to explain it, his father, that is to say, Little Hans' father, tells Freud that Hans once volunteered that it had to do with the size of a horse's penis. Freud begins to understand that the horse is not only a horse, but also stands in for Hans's father, whose penis is presumably bigger than Little Hans's. The horse's blinders are his father's glasses, his leather muzzle, his father's mustache, his father's mustache. In this interpretation, Freud believes that Hans's fears are based on a feeling of inadequacy, because since his penis is not as big as his father's, he believes his mother will no longer love him. Hans's inability to resolve his Oedipal complex results in a seemingly irrational phobia of all animals. The third case is the Wolfman case, History of an Infantile Neurosis. The Wolfman reports a dream to Freud in which he sees six or seven white wolves sitting in a tree outside the window. The wolves look more like foxes or sheepdogs because they have big tails and pricked ears. He screams and wakes up. Freud claims that the Wolfman's dream is a distortion of a scene the Wolfman witnessed as a child, the scene of his parents having sex. Freud associates the image of the wolves with coitus catergo, that is sex from behind or on all fours, and interprets that moment as a wolfman's primal scene. He claims that the dream refers to the position the wolfman saw his parents assume, the man upright and the woman bent over, rather like an animal. The wolf's fox-like tails in the dream represent the father's penis, and their white color, either the sheets or on the bed, on which the parents are having sex when caught, or alternatively the color of the father's underpants is seen from behind. So these are the three case histories. I am less interested in figuring out whether these interpretations hold water or not. I don't really care. but they do invite us to speculate about a different problem that lies outside the psychoanalytic framework proper, and yet informs the cultural value we place or use to place in such interpretations. The problem can be phrased in the form of a question. What if we were to take the animals in Freud's stories seriously, that is, as real animals, rather than as edible symbols or mistranslated figures? One possibility is a possibility offered by Deleuze and Guattari. I'm just rushing through the given here. and this is what Deleuze and Guattari have to say. Edible animals invite us to regress, draw us into a narcissistic contemplation, and they're the only kind of animal psychoanalysis understands, the better to discover a daddy, a mommy, a little brother behind them, etc. But the point of this exercise, and this is what Deleuze and Guattari are doing, are critiquing psychoanalysis, and I'm suggesting that that's not what I want to do. It is not to critique psychoanalysis as such, it is to try to understand how it is that it still informs our view of human sexuality as an animal or animalistic endeavor, while we still consider animal sexuality as non-sexual and instrumental. And the stakes could not be higher. In an area in which sexual violence and harassment are explained by as uncontrollable sexual animal desires, and those accused seek help for quote-unquote sex addiction, it is important to keep animals in mind as animals, not as symbols of truly perverse behavior. And it is in this context that Freud has something valuable to teach us. For Freud, we are all animals. Civilization makes requirements of us that dampen or repress our drives, which would otherwise be directed at biological reproduction, the perpetuation of the species, but which now sublimated also account for our greater and not so great human accomplishments. So it is to culture that we must turn if we are to come to terms with animals. Thank you.